continuous matrix product states. I was asked to give a Blackboard talk about this topic. So I will, well, what will we be talking about? This concept of continuous matrix product states. Don't worry if you don't know what this is or if you don't know much or anything about matrix product states. I will try to introduce everything. Interrupt me whenever there are questions. I will try to make it not too technical and rather highlight like the important physical consequences. If at some point you feel that, if you want some more details, I can also give them. If you feel that I'm dwelling off, also just interrupt me, let me know. So for convenience, just for ease of notation, I will be restricting to single flavor Bose gases, so just non-relativistic particles, just one type, one species of bosons. That's just for simplicity, not because it's a restriction in any way in the formalism. And so let's start by just discussing the mean field description of Bose gases in the grand canonical ensemble, so not working with a fixed particle number, and so not working in first quantization, but in second quantization. So I'll be using a pair of creation and annihilation operators. And well, for the mean field description, there is in principle no restriction on the spatial dimension. But since then the discussion about continuous matrix product state will be tailored to 1D, I will also just assume one spatial dimension. So this defines our Hilbert space, our quantum system. A typical Hamiltonian that you can look at, but is in no way, again, a restriction. Just to use some example, would be, for example, if these particles are confined to some kind of box, of length L, and then they have the typical non-relativistic kinetic energy. I won't care too much about units or constants. There could be some spatially dependent potential. And then there can be some kind of interaction. So I just take this local four-point interaction. It could be anything else. Of course, it's well known if you do this with a constant potential, you get the Lippe-Linegar model, which is exactly solvable, which is an integrable model. So it's also a good benchmark to verify certain things. So I said I want to start off with the mean field theory. And so this is, in this grand canonical ensemble, easiest done using a family of states, which are, of course, just coherent states. It should look where this phi is, of course, just a classical function. This psi is the operator. Maybe I'll sometimes I denote this with a hat to make it explicit. I hope there's no confusion. The phi is just, of course, a classical function. Written like this, well, acting, of course, on the empty vacuum, where the empty vacuum is just the one that is annihilated by all the annihilation operators. Written like this, it's, of course, not normalized. So you would need to include some kind of normalization factor, which you could normalize it exactly for, I mean, it's known exactly how this normalization factor looks like for coherent states. You would add this thing to it. And of course, you can just, since this is just a classical part, no operator, you could integrate it out and just have one number as a normalization factor. Actually, I prefer to keep it slightly more general. And just to have some extra function here, which is not coupled to any quantum operator. Well, you will see why this is convenient for later on. For now, actually, the only degrees of freedom in this function are just its integrated value. There's not really any meaning in the individual dependence on x. OK, so that's family of states. And what I want to do is just use this to derive the famous Gross-Peterski equation, which describes the mean field behavior of Bode gauses, in what is maybe not the most conventional way of deriving it. So how do we do that? We just try to write down the Schrödinger equation within the set of states, which will of course not be possible exactly. And the reason is that if you look at this left-hand side, well, so of course phi will now be time dependent, and chi as well. But I will never actually write time dependent explicitly. So just the chain rule. And of course, what you get, these variations of the state with respect to this phi and this chi, if you think about this geometrically, you can interpret this as a basis of tangent vectors to your kind of set of states, your manifolds of states that you have access to in Hilbert space. Well, it's very easy, of course, for the coherent states. This just... Yes?
Why isn't the standard thing you write down a path integral, coherent state path integral, and then just write down the solid equation for it?
That would be another way, yeah. There are several ways of deriving it. I use this approach just because it nicely generalizes to what comes next. Okay. So this is what I'm doing here, is what is known as this time-dependent variational principle of Dirac and Frankel. So you get this, of course. And then if you look at the right-hand side, I will maybe not write out everything. Well, it's just one line, right? So that's the left-hand side and the right-hand side. You use partial integration, so you need actually some boundary conditions on phi to make, for example, the boundary terms vanish. And then you get so you get these terms, and then these first two are exactly of that form that you have here. So you can already write down the first, or you can make the identification phi dot equals this, and then you will need some extra contribution to account for that. And here indeed you see you have something, this phi squared, which you cannot exactly capture by these tangent states. And so you will need to approximate this, you will need to project this onto your tangent space, and there are indeed various ways of doing this. You can indeed capture this by writing the whole problem in terms of an action and deriving saddle point equations. You can try to minimize the difference between this thing and that thing, just trying to minimize the error that you're making. A mathematics approach would be to try to to look at the difference between left-hand side and right-hand side and impose that this is For example, zero, if you project it onto a certain subspace, this is what in mathematics they usually call a Galerkin condition. And just let me try to do it in that way.
Can you say what is the equation for chi?
So this is just from if there wouldn't be any interactions, I basically from here would not have any contribution in for chi dot, and I would just have phi dot equals to this term. So let me show that by taking these interactions into account, I also get something non-trivial for chi. Of course, again, chi is not really, it's just essentially one number. It's not really meaningful to think about it as a function as having several degrees of freedom. It's just the integrated value that matters. But again, this is the way I'm setting it up like this is just to generalize nicely for the remainder of this talk. Okay, so I now already have the equations. If there wouldn't be any interactions, this would be zero, and this would be and now let me add second part. To account for this interaction term. And the way to do this is to look at the difference between this and this, just for the interaction term. So this would look like and so this would be the difference, and now we're just going to enforce that this is zero, not in general, we cannot make it zero in general, but if you project it onto a certain subspace of states, and which subspace do we choose for this? Well, exactly, of course, the same tangent space. So basically all the states of the form, phi dagger x acting on our coherent state, or just our coherent state itself. So if we enforce that this is zero, and we project it onto the state itself, well, then we can read off the equation so this creation operator will act on this coherent state in the bra, and so it gives this complex conjugated. This should be zero. That's what you get from that condition. And if you also do this for any possible psi of y that we put here, so I said we're going to project this onto all the states of the form psi dagger y acting on our coherent state. Put it in the bra. So just for any psi of y there, this would also be zero. Then we get a second, set of equations conditioned on y. And these are of the form is this still readable for everybody? Otherwise, I'd rather write it up here. So with this annihilation operator here, I will have to move it to the other side. And so I will pick up a delta function here. So what will happen is that I will actually get some terms where there is still an integral over x. Now I'll just get some local terms at position y, which I get from delta functions. So I don't get a delta function in the first term. Here I just get 1. So I get and then the non-local term. And then for the third term, I can commute once and commute a second time. So I get a factor of 2, g. These are, of course, at position y. I had a delta function. So I made a mistake here. If I, of course, use this commutator, then both phi and psi and psi dagger vanish. So I just get this. And here I get squared, and I just keep one creation operator, which I act with here, so I just get 1 phi of y. And this is also at position y because of the delta function. And then I get, again, the integrated value. It appears here. So also in this integral over x. And so the sum of this and this has to be 0, but of course what you recognize is this thing here is exactly what we got already. This is exactly the same expression as we got down here. So this whole first term vanishes because we already enforced that condition. And so we just got the contribution of I phi 2 dot is just this thing here. And if I write this in my set of equations that I had here, I get this plus 2g phi of x squared. And so that part is the famous Gilles-Pitayevsky equation. And then you get some non-trivial equation, well, some equation for this chi as well, for this normalization factor, which I just... well, I haven't even written it down. So this gives you the same term as this one with a factor of 2, and so it cancels. So I think you just get... well, it's not really fair. I mean, you cannot... The only thing that matters is this integrated value, so you cannot actually even extract an equation for phi dot at position x. The only thing that you can get an equation for is for the integrated value. And that would just look like this. But again, it's well, definitely the second equation, which is relevant and which is known as the Gilles-Pitayevsky equation. Okay. So that's coherent states, mean field theory. So now we want to do better. And we're going to use a new kind of variational ansatz. And then basically we can do the whole story, but of course I will not do it in the same amount of detail because it's... would be more work. That will just highlight how the same kind of structure emerges with some significant differences, which are nice from a physical perspective. So what will we do? There's of course various ways to motivate our more general ansatz that we will write down. Originally formulated by Frank and Ignacio Sirac as a continuum limit of matrix product states. What you can, for the way I will try to motivate it here, is just as a generalization of this coherent state. We will actually make this variational variables, this classical function phi of x. We will make it a matrix, and well, I will stick to the original solution variable names. So this matrix we will call R of x. And now we have to think about the meaning of this. I will comment on the second part later. So this is a matrix. What we have here is the exponential of, well, some argument which at various positions x doesn't commute, not because of the quantum operator, this creation operator commutes at various points, but because this matrix can depend on x, and therefore you can have at two different positions, you can have non-commuting matrices. So, well, to make this object well-defined, or, well, to give it a meaning, we'll actually use a pod-ordered exponential. And this, of course, has its origin in the matrix product structure, where you actually have a product of matrices at different positions. This pod-ordered exponential is, in some sense, doing the same thing, but in an infinitesimal manner. And, of course, we want the whole thing to evaluate to a state, because now this pod-ordered exponential is both a matrix and an operator acting on your Hilbert space. So we put some kind of boundary state here, which you could also think of as just being a d-dimensional finite Hilbert space. Just so this will be a d times d matrix. So written like this, we now just have a joint state for this d-dimensional virtual system and our physical system, which will be correlated, which will be entangled. And to actually just get a state for the physical system, we project onto a certain state for this virtual system at this site.
So d bar is a finite dimensional vector? Or
yes, so the R of X is a d times d matrix, and both this VR and this VL on the left side are d-dimensional vectors. Just elements of C.
What about the field operator? Does it have any indices? Or is it just a tensor product there?
This is just a tensor product, and the field operator is just the same one as we had before.
It's a scalar. It doesn't have any indices in there.
No, it could have. I mean, I'm just using this for notational simplicity. You could have different types of particles.
No, but it doesn't talk to R to the indices of R.
No, indeed. It's just tensor product. It doesn't have any indices, so there's no way to connect it in any way to the indices of R. And so written like this, again, you would need some kind of explicit normalization factor. And, well, as a generalization of what I wrote down before, I'll just put a second matrix here. But now this is actually relevant. So this matrix, to make it explicit, I will show that it's a matrix tensor and identity on the physical Hilbert space. So, and now, well, because also Q and R don't commute, you cannot just integrate it out and just reduce it to just one number. This Q is actually affecting also the value of the state, more than just the normalization of it.
So a quick question, instead of the vectors V left and V right, you could have also chosen periodic boundary conditions.
Indeed. If you would, what I'm talking here is indeed in a system, just particles in a box. If it would be particles on a ring, then you would choose to trace over this auxiliary system. But like, if you're familiar with MPS, like most MPS algorithms, it's more complicated to deal with periodic boundary conditions than with open boundary conditions. So that's a more general state. I kind of tried to motivate it as a generalization of coherent states. As I mentioned, the way it was originally derived by Frank and Ignacio was as a continuum limit of MPS. I'm not going over that construction again. The only thing I want to remark about this is maybe, especially if you're like coming from a high energy perspective, if you think about taking continuum limits of lattice models, then what you have in mind is indeed tuning the parameters so that the correlation length diverges in terms of the lattice spacing. That's what taking a continuum limit is all about. So taking a continuum limit, just free up the blackboard. taking a continuum limit is about sending a relation length divided by lattice spacing to infinity. But then if you know something about MPS, you might wonder, well, MPS on the lattice, they're only good for, or well, no, they're tailored for systems which have a finite correlation length. So, of course, you can study critical systems by doing a scaling in this bond dimension, so doing a finite entanglement scaling. But just having a at fixed bond dimension, taking this limit of diverging correlation length seems to be flawed. The reason is, of course, the kind of systems we're looking at here, like these Bose-Gauss, the reason that this still works and you still can describe these limits with a state with finite entanglement, at least if it's a gap system, which Boson systems typically are not. The reason that this still works is that there is some other kind of UV cutoff, which is not a lattice spacing, some length scale, and which diverges also in terms of the lattice spacing, in such a way that, of course, physically the correlation length divided by this UV length scale stays finite. And this UV length scale, for example, in a Gauss, you can think of it as being 1 over the density in a 1D, so the interparticle distance, for example. And so that's the reason why, indeed, it makes sense to write down a finite bond dimension state, even in this continuum limit. So another way of interpreting the state or looking at it is actually from a quantum optics perspective, where you can think of this auxiliary system as being, for example, some D-level system in a cavity or some D-levels of an atom, which is then interacting with these bosons, which you could think of as being the photons of a laser beam. And indeed, especially if for example, make the parameterization, in that sense, it makes actually sense to rewrite the state as so you have some kind of interaction between your D-level system and the photon field, which is this. And then you have some kind of, I've written it as I times K, and K would be a Hermitian matrix here. So you have some kind of free evolution of your D-level system in your cavity. And indeed, this it looks more general because you have this extra term here, but of course you can just rewrite this and bring it into this form where Q would actually be this free evolution minus 1/2 R dagger R. And again, in the case D equals 1, which is just the coherent state case, this was exactly this kind of normalization that we had, which normalizes the state. So the advantage of writing it like this is indeed that this is really a unitary evolution on this joint virtual and physical system. So your state is automatically properly normalized. But for the rest of the story, I will just use this more general form with this Q.
But you're equivalent, right? Sorry.
You can, well, this one you can write indeed as that form where with this specific prescription for Q. Here I will not impose this that Q takes this particular form, but you can always make it like this because there is indeed some gauge freedom. You can always rewrite it indeed like this.
So the most interesting thing for me was this P. Can you're going to tell us a little bit more about this P?
This plot ordering. This is really just telling you how to make sense out of this exponential, this moon commuting argument. You could also interpret it in another way, but this is the one that makes most sense physically. What you're doing is indeed just like integrating the Schrödinger equation, you would get some time-ordered exponential. So it's just acting infinitesimally on a small region x, with this argument, and then on the next one, and on the next
but
one.
Without the P, it would also still make sense, right?
It still makes sense, but it's not... it's a different... It would be a different state, and not one that you can think of as being a continuum limit of matrix product states. So, I mean, might be interesting to also think about what it would do without the key, but it's not something we have considered so far. Thinking about it, yeah, as really some kind of physical evolution on the joint system, it's also automatic that you get this form with this spot ordering.
Yeah, I understood that with the P, it looks like the matrix product state. A more of a quantum optics person would not use the P there.
But even then, if you would integrate your Schrödinger equation with a time-dependent Hamiltonian, you get some time-ordered exponential.
Yeah, but this is not time ordering.
But, well, this interpretation of thinking about it as a quantum optics system really... in that case, X actually plays the role of T. And in a sense, also of X, because, of course, your photons are just traveling at the speed of light. So at the same time, so if you would really want to think about it in that sense, I think the correct way to write it down would
be... What if you would do time... You could do time-dependent matrix product state calculation. So where would that be in this equation?
Yes, well, that's actually what I'm going to talk about next. But that's different than interpreting it as a system of a gravity or atom interacting with an atom and just the time evolution of that. That's a different... here we have the states at a certain time, so just one given state of a spatially dependent field can be thought of as, capturing the time evolution of this quantum optics system. Now, if you want to actually do the time evolution of this physical system, we get some equations which I will derive, which generalize this Gross-Pitevsky equation. How this actually relates back to the quantum optics system, we can think about it once we're there.
So is R literally just a continuum version of a matrix that appears in the original matrix?
It's just a matrix-valued function, yes.
But is it the matrix that appears, it corresponds to the matrix that appears on the matrix product state? How is it related to that?
How they're related? Well, they're related in the sense that in a matrix product state, you would have matrices dependent on your physical state at that point. And so the matrix Q is the one related to having done anything, not created a particle. So just the empty state on that side, if you wish. It actually be the identity plus your left spacing times Q. And having created one particle at that site would give you the matrix R with some A, which is actually the square root of A, because there is a square root of epsilon or of A normalization in this creation operator. So they're related in that sense, yes. And so as matrix product states, so this is a state which has correlations, with non-trivial correlations. So let me just show one type of, for example, correlation function. So let me first show indeed so this kind of generalized coherent states in the sense if you act with an annihilation operator on the state, what it does is it will again bring down this R. This just like in the coherent state, but in the coherent state you just put it in front of your state. Here you cannot really do this because you have all these matrices and they're ordered. You cannot just commute them to each other. So what you get is something like this. You get this spot ordered exponential from 0 to x. And so let me just introduce a shorthand notation for this. So this m from 0 to x is just the spot ordered exponential, but integrated from 0 to x. And then you will bring the r down at this position x. And then you have the rest of the spot ordered exponential. And that's it. And unlike in the coherent state case, you cannot just take this R and put it in front of your state. so it stays there. And now if you want to look at, for example, some kind of correlation function.
So M is path integral of the R's.
Well, M is really just, so this expression is M from 0 to L.
Right.
So M is just this part of the exponential and dictating what this values are here. Suppose you want to look at this kind of correlation function, for example, for y being smaller than x. If you're familiar with matrix product state, you would kind of draw these kind of tensor network diagrams. Every one of these things is a matrix product state tensor. And then you would have some kind of operator at position x and some kind of operator at position y. And the way you would evaluate this is starting from one side and just contracting this as d times d matrices. So this is these matrices of dimension d. Well, maybe from this quantum optics perspective, how would you do this? You would start, for example, if what you want to do is integrate out the photon field. So just get the reduced dynamics, the dissipative dynamics of your cavity. So just initialize your cavity in this pure state. And then you let it evolve. With these, well, what you will get if you do this, if you integrate out this photon field. Actually, got a minus. That's not that important. So you indeed see that if you would insert this form of Q, what you get is exactly a Lindlot evolution of the density matrix of your cavity system, your auxiliary system. So you would integrate this equation from the boundary at, gets a bit confusing, the right boundary is the boundary at value x equal to L, and the left boundary is x equal to 0. So you would integrate this from this right boundary up to this point where something special happens. Indeed, there you have to you have this extra insertion here, this quantum jump operator in that interpretation. So you would get rho r of x, then some r of x. And now you would need to evolve this further, again with the same equation, from this point, from x to y. And then you would get some other operator insertion. And then, well, you integrate to the left side, or you have a separate integration from that side. So if you write all of this down, what you would do is you would, in analogy, start with this VL, VL dagger, and evolve this in this other direction. So you would get some kind of row left, which you integrate up to point Y. And now I'm writing these density matrices as states in a squared system, so in a D squared system. You would get here the operator insertion 1 tensor r of y. Here you would get this Lindlot evolution, which in the squared picture looks like so this Lindlot evolution written in a pure state form, in this way, actually plays a role of the transfer matrix in an MPS case. And so this is where the correlations are encoded. This will govern how correlation functions decay. And typically, for example, you will get some exponential decay as a function of the distance. So in that sense, indeed, it really can capture strong correlations, not power law decay of correlations, but again, as an MPS case, typically if you take the bond dimension sufficiently high, then you do some kind of scaling, you can extract also, in critical cases, extract some kind of power law decay of, I mean, some power law behavior, at least for distances which are not too big, because you have this coherent sum of all these exponentials.
So just a question, you said when the bond dimension is 1, it reduces to a coherent state.
Yes.
Which, that cannot describe a Bose glass, presumably, a coherent state.
No, indeed.
Let me see that here.
Because then this whole thing just, well, then you indeed you get factorization of correlation functions. There wouldn't be any correlation. Okay. You just get the value at y independent of whether you put an operator at x or not.
So that's long range order. I mean, it's a superfluid or presumably.
If you would really just use a coherent state, what you would get typically is it's 1D, so in principle you're not breaking U1 symmetries, you don't have an actual Bose-Einstein condensate, but if you use coherent states in 1D, you just get a Bose-Einstein condensate. With explicit symmetry breaking, so because it's in a grand canonical ensemble, so there is no fixed particle number, so you really measure you can just measure the local order parameter and you would find a non-zero value. Okay, so that's just about having one of those states and doing some manipulations with this, evaluating correlation functions. So what we want to do is, of course, write down this time evolution, write down this Schrödinger equation, reduced, projected onto this set of states. And so, I think that's what I should manage to do that in 15 minutes, hopefully less. So we do the same thing. Look at the left-hand side of the Schrödinger equation, but restrict it to that set of states. So we use your chain rule. And it's more or less similar than what we had with the coherent states, except that you cannot put things in the front. So we get this at position y. We bring down this creation operator coupled to the time derivative of R, and we just bring down an identity operator, so coupled to this time derivative of Q. And that's just how it looks. Not much that you can simplify in there. Okay, and we have to compare this to the right-hand side. We already discussed indeed how psi of x acting on our state looks like. Let's solve the form. x, v, l, n, 0, x. Just bringing down an R. For example, if you want to look at the potential term, well, you just put these extra ingredients here. This one, I mean, so it's never, there are no annihilation operators in this M or anything, so it's never the creation operator. This one you can just commute through wherever you want. Like also here, I could take this creation operator and put it in the front. The thing that doesn't commute, that doesn't allow you to put this whole expression to the front, are the matrices, not the quantum operator. So I can write it like this, and so I see the potential term, well, that would be the V of x here as well, is indeed something you can write in that form, so it's something that you can exactly capture. If you want to look at the interaction, you have psi squared, psi delta squared. The psi square would actually, the second psi would bring down a second r, so you would get r squared. And then you would have two creation operators. And as in the Gross-Peterewski case, as in the coherent state case, that's a term which you cannot exactly capture, which you will have to approximate. And then the only thing I want to highlight, and so how are you doing this approximation, how you find this best approximation, is something I'm not going to work out, because that's the thing that takes too much time. But what I do want to show is that if you look at kinetic energy, well, so this expression is just that part. So now I have to act with two derivatives with respect to x, and then do this. So if I take the derivative with respect to x, okay, I will take the derivative of this r. But there's also still an x dependence here in this m, 0x and x plus l. And what this does is it actually brings down the argument of this part with this exponential again. So you get some kind of, here it comes with a plus sign because it's the upper limit of an integral. Here it comes with a minus sign. So what you get is q of x commutated with the r of x, which was already here. So that's just one derivative. And here you see, actually, this is r of x, this is r of x. And this has nothing to do with it. So this term actually drops out. So you just get this commutator with q. So let me use a shorthand notation for this. Capital D is small d. It's just a normal derivative. Plus this commutator with q. Now I have to take a second derivative. I already had this. So now what will happen, I will take a normal derivative here, and then again derivatives here and there with respect to those axes. So again bring down this commutator. This commutator will have a part q, so I will get, in a sense, generalizing this notation, a second generalized derivative. But now there's also this second part, and now this one does not necessarily cancel. This dx of r does not have to commute, it's just r. And so with this r, you have a creation operator. But there is the second, there is this creation operator here that I still have to add to this whole expression. So I'll just add one here. But now here, I will actually get the second one. So what you see is, so let's leave it like this. Your kinetic energy has a term which looks very similar to what you had in the coherent state case, in the Gross-Peterewski case, some kind of second derivative, do a slightly more general notion of second derivative, coupled to just one creation operator, which is something you can exactly capture with this time derivative. But then you get a second term, which is more like the interaction, which also has a psi x squared. So this means that even if there wouldn't be any interactions, you would just have a quadratic Hamiltonian, a free Hamiltonian, you start with a state which would be in some way prepared in a CMPS form. If you want to track its evolution, you cannot even, it would not be exactly possible to track its evolution within the set of continuous matrix quadratic states. So just the free Hamiltonian, the quadratic Hamiltonian, takes you out of this manifold. Again, this is not really a surprise to matrix quadratic states experts. They know that there's no particular reason that an MPS would be able to describe a quadratic system exactly. And so the same appears here. And so if I combine all these ingredients, I think that's kind of the central equation that we want to get to. We get our generalized form of the Gross-Peterewski equation. So we get I dt of r x, and of course t dependence, which I don't write down, is the second derivative in a slightly more general fashion, plus your potential term. And then the effect of the interactions and this you have to deal with in this approximate way, just like in the coherent state case. And it gives you, if you work this out, so you get the term of your interaction. You get this extra commutator coming from the kinetic energy. You get this coupling to this rho L and this rho R, which I introduced before when evaluating expectation values. So this is really the result of having these correlations. Your dynamics gets some kind of non-local contribution to it, because this rho L and rho R, you'd find them by integrating this Lindblad evolution. So this is kind of some coupling to the environment, to the rest of your state, which is further away, due to the correlations which are there in the state. So this is a nice equation which generalizes Hilbert-Spytalevsky. You can easily see indeed that taking the limit d equal to 1, you reproduce Hilbert-Spytalevsky, this strange derivative becomes a normal derivative again. These commutators drop out, so here you really have some kind of non-commutative behavior. And this rho L and rho R would just be 1, and then you're back at the famous Grosz-Spytalevsky equation. So let me comment on two things in the last 5 minutes. One is the origin of this, or the interpretation of this. In principle, you could actually work with a set of states where Q is equal to 0, and it wouldn't be really a restriction. You would actually still span the same set of states. So it doesn't have to be there. You could just put Q equal to 0 in that equation. The reason it's nice is what this actually results from is because, like MPS, if you're familiar with MPS, you see MPS have some kind of gauge invariants, in the sense that if you replace R with some G minus 1, which can also depend on X, and you replace Q, which is Gx minus 1, Q of X plus this way. You actually have the same state, and this now has a very nice interpretation. You see the way that Q transforms with this non-homogeneous term here. Q is actually playing the role of the gauge potential of the parallel transporter, and that's also what you get here. This form with this extra commutator is very reminiscent, indeed, of a covariant derivative in Young-Mills gauge theories. And you can actually, if you just look at one state, you only have x dependence. But if you now look at this equation, this time dependence, you can make your gauge transform also time dependent, and you can also introduce some extra kind of, so this would be like the A1 or AX. You could introduce some new matrix function which depends on X and T to play the role of the gauge potential in the zero direction and the time direction. And the way you modify this equation is by also having a covariant time derivative here. So you really get a completely gauge invariant equation for R. And then you can also write down an equation for Q, and the way it looks like is Q minus I delta X P minus I Q P equals some right-hand side, and then you recognize this as your F01, your anti-symmetric field tensor, so basically the electric field, because it's one. It's just one plus one dimensions. So you get some kind of equation for this. You get some kind of, in this virtual system, you get some nice gauge structure, which is nice from a theoretical perspective, and also very relevant, typically, in practical algorithms.
That's so where P appears in the, what is P?
P does not appear in the state. It only appears if you look at time evolution and you want to do time-dependent gauge transforms. It's like if you have gauge theory and you want to write it down in a Hamiltonian formalism, you would typically choose the gauge A0 equal choose the gauge A0 equal to 0. So you wouldn't have the connection, the gauge connection, and the time direction. Okay, so that's kind of the theory, the equations. What can we do with this in the last 2 minutes? Well, it turns out solving this actual differential equation has not been a great success so far. It turns out to be rather complicated, probably because we're also not really experts in solving partial differential equations. But there are some, well, difficult ingredients. You have this rho L and this rho R, which actually are integrated versions of your degrees of freedom. So it's more like an integral partial differential equation. You get these new terms, which are kind of hard to deal with. So there are some reasons why we have not been very successful. But of course, if somebody has knows how to tackle these kind of equations, we'd be very interested. One thing which we do understand very well is if you take this whole formalism, for example, for solving finding the down states in the thermodynamic limit, it's a nice advantage of working with MPS. You can easily work in the thermodynamic limit. Same applies to CMPS. So that's something we can do very easily, find the ground states of various models in the thermodynamic limit. And then we can still use this whole formalism in a kind of, we can do linear perturbation theory with this, so we can do linear response. So we can try to find out, for example, suppose we perturb, we drive the system with some kind of spatially dependent potential on top of this translation invariant setup, what would be the linear response? We can try to find what are the stable perturbations, so what would be the excitations in the system. These kind of things we have been using this for with great success, for example. So just thinking about the set of states that you have here, so these tangent states, if you just generalize, well, or if you just, instead of thinking about this as being the time derivative, just think about this as a new set of variational states. And especially if your ground state itself, if Q and R would be, if you would try to describe the translation invariant state, Q and R itself would not depend on X, and then you can actually go to momentum space here. You can just make the X dependence of this V and W matrix. You can just make it to Fourier mode, and so you can probe the dispersion relations of the excitation spectrum. So these kind of things. So it's a Blackboard talk, so I'm not going to show any plots. But this, if you're interested, come and talk to us. We can certainly show you plots of this. And then I think, well, so there's certainly a lot. I mean, this formalism, I here presented it for CMPS, but what I'm going into now, this deriving linear response theory, deriving excitations, also works equally well for MPS. And we're actually further with developing this whole formalism with MPS. You can actually then, once you have found out these excitations, you can actually study how they scatter. You can try to build an effective field theory on top of your ground state with this kind of formalism. And one promising, or one interesting route would indeed be in relation to what was asked before, why don't I derive these equations of motion starting from a pattern for the coherent state? Why don't I just start from the path integral and just derive the saddle point equation? Well, you could actually try to write down the path integral using this set of continuous matrix product states as an overcomplete basis. And so then what we find here as, for example, the variational optimum or the the time-dependent variational principle. This would actually just be the saddle point equation, and you could start looking at fluctuations around this. So you would develop some kind of path integral, but where your reference state, your classical state, is actually already a fully correlated quantum state.
So in that case, is there a fluctuation of R and Q as well, or not?
There would be. This is something we certainly have not. It's kind of an idea we're having. It's not something we have already like fully developed and understood. But that would be the idea, yes, indeed. That you would get some kind of saddle point solution for Q and R, and then you would start looking at fluctuations in Q and R. They would be the fields that you integrate over in your path integral. Okay, so I think I'm filled my time, and I kind of came to an end. So thank you for your attention.
I'm a little bit confused about the numerics here. I got the impression that Hamiltonian there was solved directly once with numerical MPS. People have used MPS to find the ground state using for this Hamiltonian, right, or not?
Yeah, it's definitely. And just MPS, or, I mean, even...
conventional?
Just conventional MPS, yes. But there would be certainly be situations where, for example, if your V of X is a typical periodic potential, which is very deep, very strong tapping potential, then this tends to be very natural to just discretize your whole system, and you get some Hubbert model, for example, or some Bose-Hubbert model. But if your V is very shallow, then...
But my question is really, is I thought these, your...
Even
R is equivalent. And so I was asking, why is yours, this solving this numerically more difficult than doing a regular?
Kind of, the reason is... The tricks that you use for doing MPS simulations with the typical DMRG algorithms, not all of the tricks that are involved there have been fully developed for. It's not entirely clear what the proper the way you implement DMRG in a stable manner, you use a lot of like linear algebra factorization routines, etc. And the continuum analog of that is either not always clear or is kind of
less. That's simpler then. You can discretize this thing too, right? You can say you originally have a basis.
Yes.
You get this R of X will be an R of I.
Yes.
Set of couple differential equations, but making it easier.
Sure. That in any way, if you have some non-trivial spatial dependence, I think the one more or less the only way to solve it. Differential equation is to discretize it in one way or another. The point is that while there are certain ingredients like these inverses of these density matrices here, I'm not saying we have been able to integrate this for small bond dimensions and not too difficult systems. But there are certain ingredients which just make the whole, the approach we have now less stable or less efficient than a comparable DMRG, comparable MPS algorithm. Just really technical issues about having to invert this here is something you don't have to do in a typical DMRG approach. And we have some new ideas definitely about how to get rid of this. I'm rather convinced that within the next 1 or 2 years, we will probably be come up with a good algorithm that solves these kind of technical issues. But just so far, I cannot show you like results of non-trivial, spatially dependent potentials that we have studied with this yet.
So with the course, Kudryavsky captures superfluids. Right, that's really the only thing you can get, is my understanding. So can you get a Mott insulator if you put V of X to be strongly periodic? Can you describe the Mott insulator state? Or put another way, what states are you trying to describe, or do you hope to describe ground states?
You should definitely be able if you're able to deal with I mean, strongly spatially dependent potentials, then you should indeed be able to discard the model insulating phase. For this, maybe the MPL, just discretizing it in the first place and just using normal MPS is more convenient. I think there are various interesting situations where as I said, the whole restriction to just single bosons is just for ease of notation. You can easily generalize this to having several types of particles which are interacting with each other in a non-trivial way. You can try to add impurities to the picture, see how if you insert like one or two, something I was thinking about recently is if you have some kind of different type of particle, it's just to see how it actually interacts with this uniform or this background gauss of that you would have there already.
But what is that background say? I mean, I thought with MPS you can only capture finite length correlations, and so presumably Bose glass, not insulated, you might be able to describe. I don't know what other phases you would have.
But even
besides those, but I don't
even
think,
in the,
how you describe those. I mean, I don't know. I mean, can you access those?
Even if the system isn't capped and there is actually critical correlations, this model with the uniform potential, so just the Liebig-Lenegger model, it does have power law decay of correlations, and I mean you're not. It's like even also with MPS, that situation is completely similar. In principle, you always have exponential decay of correlations, but if you make your bond dimension sufficiently big and you actually scale your results as a function of the bond dimension, you can actually also capture this critical behavior very well. You can try to extract critical exponents and Luttinger parameters and these kind of things.
I guess my question is kind of similar. So in matrix product state, but in a different way. In matrix product state, as you send d to infinity, you know you're going to get to, you can always express any state, I guess, as a matrix product state as d goes to infinity, d being this capital
yes.
bond dimension. In this case, is that true?
In principle, yes, because already the set of coherent states, form an overcomplete basis for your Hilbert space. You could express any state as a linear combination of coherent states. I mean, infinitely long linear combination. And just adding coherent states actually can be written in that form, but in a very special form where Q and R would be diagonal. I mean, which is not. I mean, you can certainly capture much. I mean, just having one dimension two, you can capture much more than just the linear combination of two coherent states, of course. But linear combination of two coherent states would definitely be included in that set just by choosing this Q and this R diagonal. And so in the same sense, if you can write a state as a linear combination of coherent states, you can trivially rewrite this in this
one coherent state, right?
What?
Is this like a linear combination of coherent states making it a matrix?
If it's a matrix, a full matrix, it's hard to think about is what it would look like in terms of coherent states. The only thing I'm saying is if you make the special choice where Q and R would be diagonal, then it just looks like a linear combination of coherent states.
Uh-huh. So,
but it's
so
much more
case,
general and much more powerful with non. I mean, you see that if Q and R are diagonal, then all the non-trivial behavior, like all the commutators that you have here, the fact that you cannot take this part and put it in front. All of this vanishes. You're back indeed at kind of the setting of coherent states where you just put everything in front.
But it's a linear combination of coherent states. It's a linear combination of coherent states that you've already claimed is going to explore the entire Hilbert space.
Yes, but the question is, of course, how many would you need?
And whether that's a good
I mean, it's going to explore the complete Hilbert space if you take limits of infinite number of terms. That was your question, if you take this limit. I'm saying, so one, and my response to what can CMPS do and if you take this limit? Well, it's clear that I can at least capture as much as, like bond dimension D can at least capture as much as this linear combination of D coherent states, much more, actually. I mean, because just D coherent states would be a very trivial CMPS. So that would certainly not be the most efficient encoding. If you have a certain state, expanding it as coherent states and then writing it as a CMPS in that form, that would not be the most efficient encoding. The way you do it with MPS using SVDs, what the continuum analogon of that would be, in, I mean, to actually get a Q and R given a state, well, the first question will be is how will you specify it to meet a state if I mean, it's a continuous system, so how will you, what other way will you encode it in? And then how would you rewrite this in a CMPS? That's something we haven't really thought about.
Okay, I think we have to stop here. Thanks a little for that.